Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, our weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, conversations with James Darrah about his direction of Mozart's Don Giovanni for the Merula Opera Program. ODC founder Brenda Way returns with Deputy Director Christy Bolingbroke to talk about the upcoming three-week festival called Music Moves. Paul Andrews from the Slavyanka Chorus shares details about the upcoming Russian Music Festival. And being the first Thursday of the month, almost, critic Joshua Cosman will be in to share his classical music picks for the month ahead. Stay with us. Pleasure to welcome back to Open Air a couple of the good folks at ODC to talk about the month-long Music Moves Festival, which gets underway this evening. Brenda Way, Artistic Director, continues to amaze the Bay Area with her vivacity and leadership of ODC, having choreographed some 82 pieces over the last 40 years. Brenda was named a 2000 Guggenheim Fellowship recipient and a resident of the arts at the American Academy of Rome for 2009. A couple of her works will be featured in the festival, which we'll talk about shortly. Welcome back, Brenda.
Thank you.
And Christy Bolingbroke was last here in her capacity as theater director. She's now the deputy director for advancement and will oversee all of ODC's external relations while continuing to curate ODC Theater's programming operations in the theater area. Christy, welcome back to Open Air.
Thank you very much, David.
Of course. Now, this a month-long festival. First of all, don't you guys want to take a little time off in the month of August like the rest
of
the world?
I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah. No, summer is a great time in San Francisco. Lots of people come and visit. And there seems to be, in general, a more open space for this kind of thing, though this summer is lively.
Mm. Well, and this was a key opportunity for us this summer because we're launching a pre-professional summer intensive program with students coming from all over the nation. And we wanted to make sure that they also had professional performance experiences as part of their curriculum in the evenings. With music and dance being the curatorial rationale all year long, this just ended up being an opportunity to jam pack the entire month.
Mm-hmm. Well, music and dance, it seems like a logical combination. So we're here, we're familiar territory here, but we're more focusing on the music throughout this festival. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, really trying to draw attention for audiences to consider the music when they watch dance. It isn't just an ambient choice. It was actually a very thoughtful consideration in terms of the choreographer choosing to work with a specific score or a musician to do an original composition and how that is rounding out the experience. So if audiences were to consider listening, both using their eyes and their ears.
So how did you decide on the guest performers that would be appearing in this?
I want to make one example for
Please.
This.
Because yeah.
I think, and this is, does relate to a guest performance, Kate Weir Company.
Mm-hmm.
She and I worked together on one of the sections of her new piece called Still Life with Avalanche. And the first two sections of that piece have sound in the environment, but as part of the emotional palette, not as part of something that the movement is connected to in any specific way. And then in the third section on which we collaborated, the music is has come forward and is an active participant in the parsing of the movement phrases. So you see it come from background to foreground in a very aggressive way. So I'm hoping that people's consciousness about the relationship to music will shift as that piece goes on.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Mm-hmm. And then there were some additional artists that I think our core audience isn't as familiar seeing all the time. I mean, we don't just curate dance, but we curate music and theater. And with some individuals like San Jose Tycho and the Bangers coming up, you know, I think people think of Tycho and they immediately think of the drums and certainly the sound. But when watching, there's tremendous choreography that they also produce in their performance that is just as visual for the eyes as the ears. And then also individuals like East Bay resident Keith Terry, and who's known for his International Body Music Festival, will be doing a one night only opportunity to truly show how to embody music.
So things get kicked off with what's called the summer sampler. Can you tell us what we'll be sampling from now until, I guess, Saturday, right?
Our flagship company, ODC Dance, of which both Brenda and our co-artistic director, KT Nelson, head up primarily, along with Kimi Okada, who is our associate choreographer. And the company, you know, is a mainstay and favorite here in the Bay Area, performing twice a year at YBCA. And what is special about Summer Sampler is that you get to see these huge works in the intimacy of our theater and venue. So it's become a perennial favorite. And this year, in particular, with music and dance as the focus, we chose to go with a couple different numbers and pieces, one of which a collaboration that Brenda did with Zoe Keating called Breathing Underwater, and then the other, a collaboration with a Jay Cloyte score called Life-Saving Maneuvers. And I'll let Brenda talk a little bit about those two pieces.
Right, indeed, Brenda.
I just want to say a flagship company makes me feel like a cheerleader a little bit. I'm liking it.
You've been here for years.
I've seen you with the pom-poms.
Yeah, and I catch it, don't I?
It works well.
Okay, so Breathing Underwater was a piece that I made a couple of years ago that was inspired by my experience with young women, adolescent women, and my interest in the development of girls. My daughter studies girls and teaches at NYU anyway. I think it's a very rich area for exploration, and it's a quartet. And the music, which is by Zoe Keating, I selected because Zoe has a very wonderful way of putting out a simple idea and then complicating it. And I felt that was kind of a perfect sound environment for teenage girls.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is simple, ever. Layer upon layer. Anyway, so that those two elements, I thought, came together in an emotional whole.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm trying to cue up the section that you suggested of breathing maneuvers. So while I'm breathing underwater.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is the Zoe music.
Yes, indeed. So let me give me another line about that while I'm cueing here.
Okay, it was played live during our season.
Do you want to talk about what we're doing special for Zoe?
Yes, actually, hold on a minute.
Sure.
Because tonight is a very, very meaningful evening for me. We are giving a benefit for Zoe and her family. Her husband was diagnosed with cancer, and he has been a great supporter of hers forever and ever, and now she has to stop what she's doing and support him. Mm-hmm. So we're giving a benefit in her honor, and all the proceeds will go to the family.
That's great. Well, let's hear a little bit of Breathing Underwater, music of Zoe Keating. You can imagine the choreography of Brenda Way. And we'll talk more about the festival. Thank you. bit of a sample of the music of Zoe Keating, which you can hear tonight for the special benefit performance for Zoe Keating's family. And Brenda Way's choreography will be featured as part of that very special performance. More about the festival. I mean, a month-long work going on here. It's a lot to do for the month of August.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was one of those opportunities also to consider what dance looks like. I think sometimes people tend to expect a dance show and a proscenium setup, and I was also very interested in what would a dance version of a cabaret look like, for example. Something in, you know, when you have the intimate experience that you sit down with a singer-songwriter and they talk you through their album and their repertory, the canon of work that they've built. And that's exactly what we have with the Singular Joe Good Performance Group. And if there was such a thing as a best of hits or album, this is what his Irresistibly Drawn would be. It is just a single album. Hour long, but it has songs that he has pulled from works that he's done over the last 28 years of his history. And I thought, what a wonderful primer and an opportunity to consider an artist, not just by the latest piece, dance work that he's put forth, but to actually share his trajectory and growth. That was certainly a significant opportunity, but then we had an opportunity to go deep with our global dance faculty, and there's a shared program with Rueda Conritmo, who does a Cuban salsa, and Namita Kapoor, who will be premiering a new work entitled Hindu Swing, and she's very much looking at the relationship between jazz dance and Bollywood, and how Jack Cole had gone and studied in India, and then came back and adapted some of those movements and hand gestures to jazz music at the time. So their whole evening will be looking at rhythm, but through dance, and considering it in that way, too.
Mm-hmm. Christy, talk to us a little bit about your new position at ODC, which I'm sure includes a hefty pay raise, given that all the extra responsibilities that you're now involved with.
And now the electricity will go off again.
Well, your enthusiasm for the organization is contagious. I mean, you just speak so well of the organization. It's wonderful that you're being able to do more for it.
Thank you. Thank you. No, it was something that I was really excited. It was an opportunity for where we're considering the organization for the next 43 years. And it's always been one that has evolved organically. And we had an opportunity to consider what would we allow us to do this more efficiently, would allow us to support more artists, would allow us to continue to put our message out there and share the work that we do with the world. And so when an opportunity came up that I could bring the art of what we do, being the curation and the relationship building with the artists, closer to the business and in the marketing and the development, all the external relations that is really meant to support the art. So I like to describe it as the art being closer to the business and the business being closer to the art. And I'm really proud of the fact that we've, I think, achieved a lot of that in our theater programming so far with the materials that we put out, that it's really informed by the work, as it has been in other ways with the school and the company. But now is an opportunity that we can do even more of that.
And this festival, I mean, can only increase the profile of ODC even further. It's a great thing to have people come to in the month of August.
Absolutely. And I would be remiss not to also share the West Coast debut of an up-and-coming artist, Dance Higginbotham. 3 years old, just a very nascent company still, but he comes with a very rich experience.
He's not 3 years old.
He's not no, 3 years okay. old. That would be actually really impressive. His company is 3 years
okay.
old.
Right.
And he's had collaborations with Alarm Will Sound and also done choreography for opera directed by Isaac Mizrahi, but he has his own voice and sort of a 21st century electronica approach to
but
dance.
But he danced with Mark Morris for a very long time.
That also doesn't hurt.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, we've got a bit of a mashup that you provided, some additional music that one would hear during the festival. This is from Life Saving Maneuvers.
Mm-hmm.
Brenda, maybe you could set this up for us.
Life Saving Maneuvers was a collaboration with composer Jay Cloyt, and I was thinking about the various ways we cope, really. Some of them humorous, some of them running, escape, dissembling, just a roster of ways that we get through life. And I worked with the dancers to create basically an episodic narrative. And the music is likewise quite various, but I'll tell you one little tidbit. It opens with a line from Mighty Mouse, and my voice, the voice was the voice of my father.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yes. Here we come to save the day.
Here I come to save the day.
That was my dad.
Oh, that's unbelievable. Thanks.
Roll it.
Thanks for sharing that little tidbit. Brenda Way, Christy Bolingbroke, thanks for coming in today, and we look forward to experiencing more of ODC during the month of August now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Greed works. Greed is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed is good. Greed is right. Greed works.
We must guard against.
Pretty funny, but I'm mad about the boy. He has a gay appeal that makes me feel there may be something sad about the boy.
Flavor of Life-Saving Maneuvers, part of the music that you'll hear as part of the ODC Dances Music Moves Festival, now through August 24th. All information about ODC and this very special benefit tonight, especially for Zoe Keating and her family, at odcdance.org. Good afternoon. David LaTulipe back with a powered-up KALW, continuing with Open Air. Well, singers from the Bay Area, North America, and Russia will gather in San Francisco beginning this Sunday for a Russian Choral Festival, the first-ever West Coast series of concerts presenting some of the most compelling, moving, and largely unknown music of the Russian choral tradition to audiences here. The four concerts of the festival will include singers from five Bay Area choirs and choruses, alumni of the Yale University Russian Chorus, along with guest singers from the Rachmaninoff Festival Choir of America. And in the concluding concert in Berkeley on August 10th, some 100 voices in chorus, including soloists from the Metropolitan Opera and the Bolshoi Theater. Paul Andrews, the president and co-founder of Slavyanka, one of the choruses involved with the festival, joins me in studio to share some of the festival details. Paul, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you, David. Lovely to be here.
Now, Paul was a member of the Yale Russian Chorus back in the late 60s while working on his undergrad degree and was co-founder of the Slavyanka Chorus in 1979. Slavyanka has toured the Soviet Union twice, meeting with and rehearsing with some of the best Russian, Georgian, and Armenian chorus, and a lot of cultural exchange work in the music front has happened during the 1980s between the Bay Area and the Soviet Union. From 2013, the Slavyanka Family Chorus officially expanded to include both men and a mixed ensemble with women singers. Paul, that must be an exciting transition for the chorus. I need to ask you, first of all, though, how lucky for us that Yale University had a Russian chorus, and why? Maybe you can enlighten us there.
Well, that's a very interesting story, David. The way it happened was actually there was a Russian club at Yale, and one of the professors and one of the members of that Yale club said, asked a young graduate student, young Russian graduate student, we need to really experience this. We want to experience this culture and get a more direct sense of what this culture is about. So young Denis Miskevich, who was a graduate student, said, I'm not going to come over and give a lecture. I'm going to bring some music. I'm going to bring a couple of bottles of vodka, and I'm going to teach these people how to sing like Russians. And that was the beginning of the Yale Russian Chorus. And since then, the Yale Chorus went on to, they've recorded extensively. They won international competitions. They did a ton of very, very early and very valuable cross-cultural diplomacy work with Soviet citizens over the years, and had a very long and illustrious history. And they're kind of our forefather. We respect what they did, and a number of us as graduates of that chorus are now members of this choir out here.
Nice. So still going strong at Yale, too, I guess.
It is. There's actually two groups now. There's a Yale Russian Chorus of undergraduates and people in New Haven, and there's also now a group called the Yale Russian Chorus Alumni, who are people who sang over the years, who gather periodically like some kind of Brigadoon chorus, and every 5 years they sing these great concerts. We just had our 60th anniversary in New Haven, about 140 men on stage. You can make some good noise with 140 men. So
I should say. Well, a very timely time for this particular festival, given all that's been going on in the news with Russia and,
yes,
and the Ukraine.
Course.
Has that affected anything at all in terms of the artists that you've been able to have involved with this festival?
No, there have been periods, as you know, when political relations between the U.S. and the USSR were difficult, and sometimes artists got drawn into those. We have not had such difficulties on this occasion. No, there's one very well-known soloist who is coming from Moscow, who's with the Bolshoi Theater, and we're very excited to have him.
Mm-hmm. The festival is announced as the third international Russian choral music festival, as well as the West Coast's first Russian choral festival. Now, can you maybe clarify that for us?
Well, we follow from Soviet, why use one word when 10 will do? So your question is about the international part or the third part, or which is the let me take them in order. International part relates to the fact that we are both we do have people coming from abroad to be part of the festival, and specifically this soloist I mentioned. What's also wonderful about this is that, as I'm sure you know, there are large Russian community, actually Russian communities in the Bay Area, and this is a chorus that's made up of people from Boston, from Yale, but also from a very, very diverse group of singers here, some of whom sing in church choirs, some of whom have no connection with Russian communities at all, some of whom are just there as singers because they love the music. So that's really very exciting to us. And as you say, it's the first festival in San Francisco, but it's the third such festival. Two earlier ones were produced and directed in Boston by our wonderful artistic director, Irina Shachneva, who has now moved from Boston to the Bay Area.
Since 2012 now, she's been director of the Slavyanka, yes?
That's correct, yes, and we're delighted.
Mm-hmm. So talk to me a little bit about the workshops and presentations that are also involved. It's not just a matter of a few concerts.
Yes, thank you. And we can talk about the concerts in a moment. There's one very, very interesting presentation a week from tonight, actually, Thursday, August 7th. And we've invited three people to come and give presentations about Russian music. One of the core purposes of the festival is to help singers and choral directors and other musicians deepen their appreciation and knowledge about this wonderful choral tradition. And so we've invited Vladimir Morrison, who's the head of Russian music publishing company called Musica Russica. He will come up from San Diego. He's probably the person in this country who knows the most about Russian choral music, and we're just thrilled that he will come and talk to us. And that is free and open to the public. It's at 1187 Franklin Street, corner of Franklin and Geary, the First Unitarian Church, 7:30 Thursday night, August 7th. So we're hoping all your listeners will come. No, not all of them, but enough to fill the room.
Sure. And full details about that are at russianmusicfest.us.
Yes, and also I should mention Harlow Robinson, who usually gives the lectures at the Boston Symphony when they do something Russian, and then Alexander Prokhorov, who's an internationally known vocal instructor. The three of them will be presenters that evening.
Mm-hmm. So where does your personal fascination with Russian music come from?
You know, that's a good question. I think I was just taken by this music when I was in college, David. I think there's something about it that is just, it's sort of like discovering that you have a you have a sort of kindred spirit or a brother 40 years into your life, you discover a brother you didn't have, you know. And I think a lot of musicians are beginning to discover that about Russian music in general, that this is a choral tradition that we don't know enough about. And I'm reminded of a friend of mine who went down to the Crystal Cathedral, you know, the big glass structure down in Los Angeles. He came back. I said, what was it like? He said, I'm sure it is spiritually meaningful to a lot of people, but for me, there was so much light in there, there was no place left for any mystery to hide. Mm. You know? And the wonderful thing about Russian music is there's lots of room for mystery to hide. And I think it's a music that has very deep feeling to it, a very deep spiritual sense to it. And I think that's very attractive to Western musicians who are used to other kinds of repertoire.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the liturgical side of the sound of Russian choral music, and then we'll talk more with Paul Andrews, director of the Slavyanka Chorus. Sample of the choral music of Slavyanka. That was an excerpt from Let My Prayer Arise by Chesnokov. Beautiful sound there. And that's from a recording of Slavyanka called Russia Old and New. Very nicely done, Paul.
Thank you.
So things are starting off with kind of an introduction as to why Russian choral music is different from other choral traditions.
Why is this music different from all other music, to slightly misquote a phrase?
Yeah.
I want to talk about that in the context of our first concert, David, which is this Sunday, August 3rd at First Unitarian Church in San Francisco. This is a concert dedicated to the two roots of Russian music. And there was one thing I would want to sort of communicate to your listeners, it's about this basic sort of architecture, the basic roots of Russian music. You know, when the Christian faith came out of Israel back in ancient times, it landed in, first of all, in Greece. So you had these Hebrew prophets, you know, colliding with Greek philosophers, and out of that came Western civilization. Well, in Russia, it was very different. The Christianity that went to Russia was Byzantine, 8th century Byzantine, very mystical, and the ground that it landed on was utterly pagan folk music. So you had this very different collision, and it's out of that collision that we have these two roots, this very mystical sound and this very pagan, earthy sound. And our concert, our opening concert is called the Heaven and Earth, the Roots of Russian Choral Music. And I think that creates a context in which people can better understand where this music comes from and why it can be different than Russian music, than Western European.
Two remarkable soloists will perform at the festival. Andrei Nemzer, countertenor and winner of the Metropolitan Opera Competition in 2011. And Mikhail Svetlov, an extraordinary bass soloist from the Bolshoi Theater in Moscow. It's quite a coup to have these folks perform for a part of this festival.
Well, we're delighted that they're coming.
And the final gala festival involves a gala choir. I imagine
100
voices.
100
yeah.
voices.
It's all. It's from various groups.
Yes. It's a combination of. It's a real potpourri of both repertoire and singers, and it'll be sort of a reprise of many of the other three concerts first concert is about the roots of Russian music. The concert on August 8th in Berkeley is just these two soloists. We're doing a vocal recital at St. Mark's Church in Berkeley. The 9th is the Yale Russian Chorus Alumni and Slavyankin, a concert all of male repertoire. That's at First Unitarian in San Francisco again. And then the Sunday concert will be bits from all those concerts, but then a whole lot more of what some modern compositions that are premieres here.
Fantastic. All the information of this wonderful festival running through the 10th of August at RussianMusicFest.us, or you can visit the Slavyanka.org website. Now, interestingly enough, I just learned the roots of the word Slavyanka. I'm a habitué every now and again of the Russian River up in Guerneville area, Monterio.
Right.
I had no idea that the settlers there called it the Russian River, but the Russians actually named the river. It has a Russian name.
Go figure. Right.
And what's that name?
Slavyanka.
Slavyanka.
Yeah. And Russians have a long history in California. That's the subject for another time. I know we're near the end of time, but
sure.
Lots of different. We have a long connection. We have a picture somewhere of Rachmaninoff standing in front of a redwood tree.
Mm.
So a lot of Russian American connection in this concert as well.
We'll talk about that shortly, off the air, I think. Anyway, we're just going to listen to a little bit more music of Slavyanka. This is the work called...
Hajdulia.
Hajdulia. All right. Again, information about the festival at RussianMusicFest.us or at Slavyanka.org. I should also mention that on September 13th, Slavyanka will be having a special concert celebrating the 50th anniversary of St. John the Baptist Serbian Orthodox Church. You can visit Slavyanka.org to learn more about that concert as well. Thanks for coming in, Paul.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Music of Slavyanka. Learn more about the Russian Choral Music Festival from August 3rd to August 10th at slavyanka.org or at russianmusicfest.us. My next guest, James Dara, has developed quite a reputation as a director to watch on all kinds of collaborative artistic projects. He's directing the Marilla Opera Program's production of Don Giovanni, which has performances tonight and Saturday. And if you're a regular at the San Francisco Symphony, you've seen his incredible multimedia stagings of both Peer Gynt and Peter Grimes. Other recent work includes the world premiere of Frank Zappa's 200 Motels with the Los Angeles Philharmonic and Esa-Pekka Salonen, for which he also collaborated with Christopher Alden for the L.A. Philharmonic's Mozart da Ponte trilogy. A directing debut with Opera Omaha, Pacific Music Works in Seattle, projects at Lincoln Center, and collaborations with Peter Sellers and John Adams' new The Gospel According to Other Mary in L.A., London, Paris, Lucerne. He trained as a director-designer with the Croatian National Theater and the Split Summer Festival, and has taught theater and performance for the Adler Fellowship Program of the San Francisco Opera, Cornish College of the Arts, and UCLA, where he was also the recipient of the George Burns Gracie Allen Directing Scholarship while working on his MFA there. James, welcome to Open Air.
Thanks.
Now, first of all, fantastic work for both Peer Gynt and Peter Grimes with the San Francisco Symphony. How did that relationship start?
I was introduced to music director Michael Tilson Thomas through my work in Los Angeles with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. The head of artistic planning there, Chad Smith, has become a good friend and is a really, really great creative thinker about projects and ways to, I think, develop orchestral work in a, you know, in a modern way for a modern audience, also in a very visual way. And one of the first people to hire him in his career was MTT. And so there was, I think the symphony kind of contacted him at one point, and I had at this point been working in LA for the Philharmonic, and the symphony contacted him and sort of asked if he knew anyone that could collaborate in a very specific way with MTT on the Peer Gynt project, which was kind of theater and a lot of video and obviously the Grieg and music and very kind of multimedia and also kind of sprawling in a really intimidating way.
Yeah, okay.
And I think they were looking for both somebody to collaborate with him, but also kind of like a design aesthetic and perspective and one that could be really collaborative and interesting. And I think all of that happened really quickly. I forget where I was, and I got, it was like a month and a half before that. I mean, it was really, you know, as opposed to the opera world, which I feel like plans things years and years and years in
sure,
advance.
Sure, necessity, yeah.
Out of necessity, that was kind of an exciting thing in a really positive way, because it was kind of having a really great idea and deciding how to make it happen and kind of just going. And I think I flew up here the week after they contacted me and met Michael for the first time. You know, I'm, you know, consistently amazed at how creative he is and also how in tune he is with theater. I mean, he comes from such a large theatrical background and with his family and also just has really good taste with what he wants in terms of theater and drama and how all of that mixes with orchestral music. It's unlike anybody else I've encountered in terms of programming. So that was exciting for me. I mean, that was kind of the first project that was interdisciplinary in that context.
So Peer Gynt and then the Benjamin Britten so collaboration for the 100th anniversary.
So that went, so the first time here was fun and we had a good time and very, you know, very different thing than Peter Grimes. Peter Grimes exists as it is and is this kind of, again, massive three-act opera, but also very character-driven and a fascinating piece when you look at the history of Britten writing that piece. And so Michael had programmed it and then kind of came and said, you know, what could we do that is interesting with this piece or stages it? And the thing that I said to the symphony was, there's this weird term of like semi-staged, which I always find funny because it's like a director works on a piece and the level of production can always change. And you can be in a situation where an orchestra is on stage, which I actually find really thrilling because you're watching how all of those forces work. And you're watching, you know, in this case here, you're watching MTT work with the San Francisco Symphony. And that's part of the visual landscape of what you're doing. But you don't semi-direct things. Like, you either direct them or you don't.
That's true, yeah.
You know, like, you don't say, like, we've hired a Grimes and he's going to semi-sing. Like, he's going to semi-sing the role. And so I always say, like, you know, I don't know where that comes from, actually,
it's,
even.
I guess it's because it's such a unique thing. It's not in a black box. It's not on a stage.
Yeah.
It's a combination.
And it's not a proscenium thing. And so it's like, how do we categorize this? And
well, every collaborative project must present its own set of on-site specific challenges.
Absolutely.
It's not like creating for a traditional stage that can be transported elsewhere around the world. You've got
right.
some very specific things in different halls.
Yeah, I mean, here the challenge is the symphony hall and how to, you know, I said to them very early too with Peer Gynt and with Peter Grimes, specifically Peter Grimes, because it's been done in opera houses. And I said, we shouldn't try to turn the symphony hall into a proscenium theater. To me, that seems like the wrong, like we're not trying to create San Francisco Opera across
right.
the street.
Yeah, sure.
We're
sure.
doing this other thing.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about playing with the Marilini.
Yeah.
Now. You're working with, they've gone through a lot to get to be in this program, so they're a very strong group of young singers. But I'm wondering what the differences are working with such a younger cast as opposed to more seasoned professionals in the opera world.
Yeah, and this summer, actually, for doing these two projects back to back, they actually overlapped, which was really kind of insane also and really fun. right as Grimes was ending, we started with Giovanni at Merla also. And so it was definitely that contrast became really clear. What's amazing is with Merla, what's exciting there is you have this crop of singers that represents some of the best singers in the world currently. And they're all incredibly excited about what opera can be in the coming decades. They're all incredibly interested in digging into a piece and into theater. And it's really fascinating to go into that environment. There's kind of a desire to be very physical within a role and do something that is at once both musical and honors Mozart's, you know, score, but also feels fresh and exciting and new. They all want that. And that kind of, I think, youthful energy is really, really, really exciting. Mm.
Were you able to bring any of the experience that you had with the LA Philharmonic's Mozart Da Ponte trilogy into this production of Don Giovanni, or the apples and oranges? Mm.
The short answer is yes. I think anytime you're in an environment where you're working on a masterpiece like Mozart's operas, especially the Da Ponte operas, with someone like Christopher Alden, who knows them so well and is interested in, you know, the momentum that opera can have culturally and also artistically, like visually, that was a huge experience for me to learn and see how, you know, a creative mind can dig into what Mozart gives you and really activate it in an exciting way.
Mm. Let's talk about what we'll see for the Merla production of Don Giovanni. You've got some limitations in the venue, Everett Middle School Auditorium, so that must be your first consideration.
The tech crew for Merla and everybody have, like, transformed that space and made it a pretty amazing theater. Uh-huh. Like, you know, I definitely think at first, it's funny because they kind of say, like, oh, we're going to this middle school where we're performing, and we're all like, what?
Hello?
But there's actually, you know, it was built when schools had real theaters in them. Yeah, it's a cool space. And so I think what's good about that is that the opera houses in this country, the major opera houses, are huge, 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 huge spaces, whereas the European houses are not as big. And doing Don Giovanni in a space that is smaller than your average U.S. massive barn opera house is actually kind of cool and kind of what it also should be. There's also no pit in this theater. There's space for the orchestra, but it doesn't lower down. So what I always think is kind of like we were talking about the symphony works, but also like doing a lot of early music or things where the pit would have been higher anyway. And in this case, certainly historically, it has application for Mozart. And we see the orchestra. I mean, you see the conductor, you see the orchestra. They're on the floor, kind of, you know, the stage is elevated above them, but there is no pit rail. There is no kind of, you know, person waving their hands at the audience from this, you know, deep recess under the stage. So it's actually kind of nice because you get a richer sound in some ways, and we see the way all of that works. And with all of the harpsichord rested, there's coordination between pit and stage in a really nice way, especially mm-hmm. for the young cast, who's really kind of making some nice theater out of those accompanied recits.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm giving anything away by telling that the final climactic scene of Don Giovanni has the statue of the Commendatore coming to life and urging the rascal Don to reform his ways or be pulled into the fires of hell. And many productions have quite a visual representation of that. So what might we see without giving away too much on the Everett School Middle Auditorium?
I think what's really exciting about this is this cast has embraced the idea of how to work with what I always think of as like enigmatic ambiguity, and in a really interesting way that it's an metaphor. And I'm always interested in kind of anything but the trite obvious. And Don Giovanni certainly being one of those operas that is done all of the time. I've seen it work very well with a full traditional banquet scene, and I've seen it be really boring with a full traditional banquet scene. And out of necessity here at Merla, where the emphasis is on the singers, and so not on me demanding, you know, 4 months worth of prop work, what we've invented is actually like a really cool, I think, really exciting kind of visceral, physical staging for the last scene.
And so is it more of a traditional costumed way of approach, or are you modernizing
it? No, yeah, I mean, it's modernized, but I would say that it's more, what always interests me is kind of like a, it's an invented world. It's an invented timescape. I mean, you can't really tell what time it's set in. You know, the emphasis and the focus is on the cast and on the relationships between people and on the music. And there's definitely some modern influence. The design team here with me was really intrigued by the idea of Giovanni as kind of a self-destructive, creative individual. So we play with what that means to be a creative person, which we found very quickly, like, we all identified with. This sort of like, oh no, we're sort of making a show about ourselves and how insane all artists are. But it's good, you know, for, not giving anything away. But I mean, you know, like the catalog aria actually becomes my set designer is a really talented painter and has a great hand. And she did all of these beautiful nude drawings in sketchbooks. And the whole catalog aria of his conquests are like that he has seduced these women and, you know, drawn them probably before other activities occur. There was an audible gasp in the final dress rehearsal when Leporello pulled these kind of gorgeous but also like really shocking nude drawings out of this book. And, it's to me, that's really exciting because that's nothing against what's in the text. Like, he's talking exactly about that. Yeah. And so, you know, turning Giovanni into somebody that is creatively inclined, I think it was cool. All the singers and all the whole cast, you know, they're all creative people too. So I think they all kind of got where we were interested in taking it. And there's some really fun things. So I won't give away too much, but but it's exciting.
That's James Dara. He'll be directing the Merula Opera Program's production of Don Giovanni tonight at 7:30 Saturday. Tonight at 7:30 Saturday at 2:00 at the Everett Auditorium. Information at merula.org. Well, James Dara, thanks for taking some time today, and thanks for bringing such a fresh perspective to some of these works.
Oh, cool. Oh, yeah, it's fun.
De festa, de prodigio, di verità, de prodigio, verità, e verità, e verità, e la tutta di verità.
E pensa,
e dormi di pensiero,
vita,
e sa per la testa,
e si salva, e sa la testa, e pensa, e la morità.
Part of the amazing second act finale, the Sextet from Don Giovanni. Joshua Cosman joins me in studio now to talk more about some other picks for the month of August ahead. But this was one of your picks, the Merula Don Giovanni.
It was on my list, and when I saw that you had James Dara in here on the show, I thought, well, all right, he'll pitch it well enough.
We got that plug, merula.org, for those performances of Don Giovanni.
And I'm going tonight, and looking forward to that. And then, of course, also Merula finishes up next weekend on the 16th with the big grand finale in the Opera House. I don't know if that got mentioned, but
it did not.
That's worth noting as well. It's always one of my favorite events.
We're actually a media sponsor, so we've been announcing as underwriting the big gala.
So, all right. So it's kind of a conflict of interest for me to plug it here, but I like it anyway. It's a chance to see all the Merulini kind of troop across the stage in singles and pairs and ensembles and do their thing. And
you really, top of their game, really.
Absolutely. Yeah. You get a wonderfully varied kind of mix of opera, a repertoire and styles and all kinds of good stuff. So that's next Saturday on the 16th in the Opera House.
Cabrillo is underway.
Almost. Starts this weekend. That's next on the agenda. I mean, it's always, August is always festival time around here. That's kind of what we do in August, is we go to this festival and that festival. And the Cabrillo Festival of Contemporary Music, to give it its full title, which opens Friday night in San Francisco with music director Maren Alsop back in the saddle. She was sidelined last season with an injury and now is back and, I guess, in good health.
So you mentioned it's in San Francisco, the opening.
Did I say San Francisco?
You did.
When I said San Francisco, I meant Santa Cruz. Forgive me. Thank you for the correction. I get those two confused all the time. But Santa Cruz...
As long as you didn't say Santa Frisco.
No, that would be not a good point. Anyway, yes, Santa Cruz, opening this Friday night with Bela Fleck, the great multi-talented banjo virtuoso, and also composer, has written a concerto for himself called The Imposter. I talked to him a couple weeks ago and put a story in the Chronicle today about that. Sounds like an interesting piece. It's certainly gotten a lot of play around the country.
If you don't want to buy a Chronicle, go to sfgate.com.
Sure. I don't need to put my kid through college. And also on the Friday program, a couple of pieces that I'm looking forward to. One by a composer named Andrew Norman, who's becoming quite an interesting big name in certain circles, and somebody whose work I think is always interesting and provocative. And he's got a new piece called Play, about which I know nothing more than the title, and a world premiere by Dylan Mattingly, who's a young Berkeley resident who has been taken under the wing of John Adams and Juana Carneiro at the Berkeley Symphony and other local people, and is really kind of making a name for himself. He's about 22 or something like that. Also this weekend, Time for Three, the great string trio, classical trained but sort of genre busting, are going to be doing a new concerto written for them by Jennifer Higdon, who's a favorite of Maren Alsop and the Cabrillo programming, a piece called Concerto 4-3, number 4-3. So I guess it's a F-O-R pun and a musical pun. I'm not sure how that all works out. Mm-hmm. And music also by Mark Anthony Turnage and a young composer named T.J. Cole out of Philadelphia, who interests me because I don't really know much about her.
Okay.
That's this weekend, opening at Cabrillo in Santa Cruz. Next weekend, 9th and 10th, more stuff, including John Adams' new saxophone concerto with Timothy McAllister as soloist. That's the guy who for whom it was written, who premiered it, and who has recorded it with the St. Louis Symphony and their conductor, David Robertson. There'll be music by Gabrielle Smith and Brett Dean. And then on Sunday, the 10th, Nadia Salerno-Sonnenberg, who is familiar to us from her solo career, of course, and also more recently as the artistic director of the New Century Chamber Orchestra, is going to put in a solo appearance doing some of the pieces that have been written for her and for the New Century over the last few years by Michael Dougherty and Clarice Assad. So that's the second weekend of Cabrillo. All that information is at Cabrillo Music. org.
We've actually got a little excerpt of the Adams, I believe.
Sure. This is a recent recording on Nonesuch of the Adams Saxophone Concerto with David Robertson conducting the St. Louis Symphony and Timothy McAllister as the soloist.
And then more with Joshua Cosman. Thank you.
sampling of the new saxophone concerto of John Adams, which you can hear as part of Cabrillo Music Festival's second weekend. Go to cabrillomusic.org. David LaTulipe here with Joshua Cosman. Josh, what else is on your August hit list?
Well, more festivals. The Music at Menlo Festival, now in its 11th season. It's remarkable what they've been able to do and establish down there. Every season, of course, has a focus in the programming, and this year they're doing Dvorak, which means that they get to do not only Dvorak, but all kinds of interesting thematic spin-offs. One of them is a program of other Czech composers that's going to be repeated on August 8th and 9th, which will include music by Smetana, by Erno Dohnányi, Aaron Schulhoff, and Dvorak himself. They're going a little bit south from there to Hungary on the 5th. With music by various Hungarian composers, Bartók, Liszt, Ligeti. And, of course, Dvorak famously spent a couple years in the United States, in New York and in Iowa, and that was enormously influential on his composing. And so tonight, actually, in Menlo Park, you can hear a program of all American-themed program, let's say, because there'll be Dvorak on the program, but also music by Charles Ives, the great American maverick and revolutionary composer, and George Crumb, music for percussion, songs, and chamber music by Dvorak. That festival started last month and is continuing this month through the 9th of August in a couple of locations in Menlo Park and Atherton. And the information for that is on the website, which is musicatmenlo.org. It's Music AT Menlo, even though the name of the festival has an at sign, but they couldn't put that in the website because internet.
All right. Yeah, right. Yeah. Musicatmenlo.org.
Right.
Fantastic. Opera on your list.
Opera on my list, but still festivaling, because West Edge Opera, which is this terrific company that's been going for a long time. Some of us still remember it as Berkeley Opera, but I think I'm going to stop saying that now because they've really established their new identity quite firmly. They're doing a lot of interesting things over the years. But this year, they've been kind of homeless. They've been looking for venues, and they found this place in Berkeley, a school facility near the Ashby BART station in Berkeley. And it has this great big open atrium where they're staging their pieces this month. They're doing all three of their programs in one sort of consecutive festival, and it's a terrific lineup. The first one was La Boheme, and everybody said, well, La Boheme, okay. But this is by all reports, now I haven't been to it. I was out of town on the opening performance, but I've heard wonderful things about this, very interactive. The playing space, there's no real division between the audience space and the performers. So there's a lot of pulling audience members out of their seats and interacting with them during the performance. I'm going to go next weekend and looking forward to it hugely. In the meantime, though, I have gone.
Maybe your stage debut.
Yeah, no. Now, Mark Straczynski, who directed it, promised me that they are not going to pull anybody in who doesn't really want to be part of it. But I want to put in another plug in addition to my review in the paper earlier this week for Hydrogen Jukebox, which is the Philip Glass opera setting, the words of Allen Ginsberg. That really was a knockout performance. Very beautiful, very exciting. And they're also doing The End of the Affair, which is composer Jake Heggie's treatment of the Graham Greene novel, which opened a few years ago in Houston.
Wow, that should be fantastic.
Those three pieces are alternating through the next couple weeks through August 9th at the Ed Roberts campus in Berkeley.
WestEdgeOpera.org. Finally, right. Yo-Yo Ma is coming to town.
Yes, Yo-Yo Ma is going to be here for one night, August 12th, playing three of the six Bach cello suites at the Greek Theater. Cal Performances, a special Cal Performances presentation. And I see I'm running out of time, so I don't know what more to say other than Yo-Yo Ma and Bach.
Yeah.
You can't beat that.
Cannot go wrong. CalPerformances.org for more information on that. Thanks so much for the 10 minutes once again with Joshua Cosman and bearing with us on this very awkward day at KLW.
It sounds like you've had some some difficulties, but I'm glad you're past them now.
We are indeed. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you, David.
Also, I do need to put in a little plug for the Oakland Municipal Band, oaklandmunicipalband.org, this Sunday at 1 p.m. I've been asked to play a little
flute and piccolo with them. So I'm going to be at Lake Merritt this coming Sunday at 1. Stop by, say hello if you're around. Jewish Film Festival is also going through the 10th of August. So check out sfjff.org. And Melissa Etheridge with the San Francisco Symphony tonight, sfsymphony.org. Thanks, as always, to Neil Swinkles, and a special thanks to Kevin Vance for subbing these last 2 weeks. I'm David LaTulipe. Thanks for listening.